Right. Get started. I want to talk today a little bit more about Luther's personal life for the first 10 minutes or so. Then I want to go on to discuss politics in the empire between the years when the Peasant War ended, 1525 and 1552. That's 3 years. 3 years before one of the big, the great dividing lines in the history of the Holy Roman, history of Germany, history of the Holy Roman Empire, history of Europe occurs. The year is 1555. We'll discuss that more on Thursday. Before we go on, let's talk a little bit of about some of the things that we've been discussing recently. I want to know the meaning of the word estate. I want to know the meaning of the word evangelical. I want to know the meaning of the word estate, the meaning of the word evangelical, the meaning of the word humanist. Who wants to start? Hunter?
I'll do evangelical.
All right, that's the easy one, but go ahead.
It's all groups opposing the church.
It's all groups opposing the church. There's going to be a new word introduced today. Evangelicals are basically all groups opposing the Roman Catholic Church. Estates. Okay. I may not have emphasized that enough. Go ahead.
Are these like the 10 circles within that?
That's part of it, but that's an estate, yes. Kevin?
Charlie, sorry.
All right, okay. Where's Kevin?
Hi.
Kevin. Hunter is there. Where's Cody? Cody, are you here? Oh, all right. Go ahead.
Nathan.
Not quite, Nathan. Estates are, again, I should have emphasized this more. It's used all in the literature. Estates are groups, responsible to the emperor, corporate bodies responsible to the emperor in some way, shape, or form. The princes are an estate. In the 10 circles of the Holy Roman Empire, their assemblies, state legislatures, they are an estate. The cities are an estate. Bodies responsible in some way to the emperor, and he's responsible to them. They're entitled to be consulted by them, and he's entitled to consult them. Their corporate groups, go ahead. No. They could be the circles of the empire, the 10 states of the empire. In those circles, there are provisional legislatures, diets themselves. They are estates as well. They're basically corporate groups. To the power brokers, must in some way answer, and they answer to him. Basically, they answer. He's entitled to, the princes of the empire are a good example, the cities of the empire are a good example, and the 10 circles of the empire are a good example. The governors of these 10 circles, they are estates. The legislatures in these 10 circles, they are estates. They're basically groups, corporate groups, responsible to powers. Could be the emperor, could be the princes. How about the word humanist? Go ahead.
Humanist emphasizes the power of human reason and ethics, and it rejects supernatural dogma.
Good, Derek. Very good. Personification of the idea of man. Who personifies the humanist?
Erasmus of...
Rotterdam. Good. Erasmus of Rotterdam. Okay, now some I was talking to at the faculty reception on Thursday, at the front left, Friday night. I was talking to Tom Brady. And we were talking about how to view this whole concept of Anabaptism. He agreed, although I think grudgingly, he agreed with the characterization that we were going to give it. Anabaptists, for our purposes, are a sect. a specific sect. But lumping all the dissidents from Luther together, the belief in a rebirth and a rejection of infant baptism, that too can be used as a definition of Anabaptist. I don't think it works that well for purposes of understanding. All right, we have these dissident groups. What is Karlstadt? If you had to name one thing that Karlstadt stood for, what he dissent, what would it be? Derek.
The spirit is supreme.
Well, yeah, that's one thing. I want something else.
You want to be called brother.
Bro. Okay, that's the word. Dude'll do. He wanted to have a democratized congregation. All right, that's, go ahead. He wanted a theocracy, foreshadows someone we're going to be talking about next week whose name is John Calvin. That's correct. All right, what is Zwingli's main point? That he believes in the New Testament. Go ahead, Philip.
Matthew,
I'm sorry. Puzzulo, right? Yes. Well, I got the last name, okay.
He believed that communion was symbolic.
Communion was symbolic, not real. That's go ahead. That's it. Yes. He believes that the Christ is only symbolically present in the Last Supper. That's the main thing he emphasizes. Symbolically, and also he's ready to draw the sword. He's ready to draw. What about the Anabaptists? What's their shtick?
Adult baptism.
Yes. Renunciation of violence would be the other thing. That's another point. All right. What is Luther's attitude toward the Anabaptists? Hunter?
He's not very fond of, I think, Lutherans. I don't really agree with them.
Not very. Oh, on what grounds?
Isn't it that...
Someone want to pick up the running? Yes, sir.
I think Luther aligns himself with the principles. So the Anabaptists would be a real principle for the
Anabaptists. Not very good. They renounce violence. They say they won't serve the state. That is sedition. Although in the eyes of Martin Luther, it's going to become in the eyes of one, and it can be it's punishable by death. Luther and the Anabaptists. What about Luther and Zwingli? They get along. Why? Zwingli wants to fight, and Luther doesn't want to fight. Zwingli wants to fight, and Luther wants to pick up. And also, the more important is the doctrinal. The doctrinal difference. Luther looks at the Bible and says, "This is my body. Christ is present. Christ is present in the Last Supper. The body of Christ is present, physically present in the Last Supper. Not changed, as the Catholics say, but physically present in the Last Supper." Zwingli says, no. The way I'm reading a different text. I'm reading the real Hebrew. I'm reading the real Greek. And it says, this, my body. This symbolizes my body. And there's a big difference doctrinally between Luther and Zwingli over that one issue. What happens to Luther as a result of the peasant wars? Let's pick that up. Anything? One. Go ahead, Alex.
The princes in the church view him as responsible.
Yes, I'm going to change. Initially, the princes in the church view him as responsible for starting the whole thing. And Luther writes the famous pamphlet. What does he say? What are the words? Smote, slay, stab the murderous peasant. Because he's picking up, he's taking the sword into his own hand. Taking the sword into his own hand. And again, that's a crime against Luther. Thinks that's a crime, a very big crime, a crime just as bad as blasphemy. What other results of the peasants' war can we happen? Good, Matthew. Yes, a distinction between theological salvation and earthly salvation. Anything else?
Peasants become more free than ever.
Freer than in other parts of Europe. They get a lot of what they want. They're not treated too well now. Who's the peasant, the most radical of the peasants? I should have said that. Who's the lead? Munster is a bishop, basically. What does he believe in? Where? Pardon? Denies baptism at all? Maybe. At first, yes. Okay, they'll take it. But man, what does he believe in? God speaks through, and the Spirit is present in an elect. The peasants are an elect. What should the elect do?
Take up arms.
Kill the ungodly. Kill the, and it gets so bad, so bad that he makes a truce. His followers make a truce. They make a truce, and the truce is broken. And the Schma, and who's the league that the peasants fight? The league the peasants fight. The Schwabian League comes in and crushes the peasants who have taken up arms under Munster. What happens to Munster? Munster. Let's make it a little more. Oh, come on.
Creditor-wise, banishes him from Saxony.
He's hounded. He tries to escape. He does escape. He's caught. He's interrogated. He's tortured. He's blinded. And then he is beheaded. The executioner. They get paid. I'm sorry? The Catholics, yes. The Schwabian League is... Remember, who fights... That's a good point. Who fights in these peasants' wars? Catholics and Lutherans. On what side? On both sides. Very good. Alistair? All right, so let's pick up the story. After this. Let's talk... The result. One of the results of the peasants' war. Is that nuns, there are nuns, more and more nuns are fleeing their covenants. More and more nuns are fleeing their covenant. Luther arranges for their escape in many instances. Luther feels responsible after attacking the nuns, attacking the priests. Luther begins to feel responsible for the fate of the nuns. He writes pamphlets in favor of the nuns. The nuns who have broken out of their cloister and who are marrying priests. And he decides to lead by the power of example. So in June of 1525, before the peasants' war is even over, Luther takes a wife. Her name is Katrina von Bora. Katrina, it's not his first choice. His first choice basically turned him down. How would you like that? She's his second choice. Maybe at least second choice. I don't know. But they're married in June. They're married in June 1525. Luther, at this time, Luther doesn't have a dime to his name. Luther's basically broke. He's famous, but he's broke, believe it or not. He never takes one penny for his books. Not one penny does this man take for his books. Now he's got a wife. And soon, so guess what happened? Soon they have one child, and the one child becomes two, and the two become three, and finally he's got six kids. Luther begins to learn a trade, wood cutting. Katrina, Kathy as she's called, Kathy begins to take up a trade herself. Katie Katie becomes responsible for taking care, for supporting the household, for supporting the household through various tasks that she does. I'm not sure whatever the biographies differ. She becomes responsible for supporting the household. Interesting relationship they have. They have, Katie calls Luther. Katie never calls Luther Marty or Martin. She calls him Doctor. Doctor or Dr. Martin. And she always refers to him by the German plural, the Z, not the Du, Z. Very formal relationship they have, or Vu or Usted in Spanish. Luther at this time, Luther developed ideas on marriage, ideas on the family that affect German society, for the next 500 years. Affect German society for the next 500 years. One, the man, the husband is the head of the house. Adam came before Eve. The man is the head of the house. He wears the pants. The wife is to be loved. The wife is to be loved as someone would love a neighbor. Wife is to be loved as someone would love a neighbor. She's the dearest neighbor that Luther has. Katie, the dearest neighbor that Luther has. Three, the wife is responsible. The wife is responsible for raising the children. The wife is responsible for raising the children. And the children have an absolute duty. It's in the Bible. Luther believes this as much as he believes about the peasants and about the presence of Christ in the sacrament. The children that have a right, the disobedience is not to be tolerated. It is a sin. It's a sin for children to disobey. To disobey their parents, and as sin to disobey their parents. This idea lasts basically in Germany for 500 years. This idea that Luther has. They have six children. Luther does. Luther likes the marriage. The marriage to all intents and purposes, the marriage is a happy marriage. The marriage is just continue. What it was before Luther, I think it was that was more open and fluid as far as the arrangements were concerned. There was no one that said that the children who disobeyed should be punished, even though that does happen. Yes, go ahead.
Isn't honor thy mother and father
one of the commandments? You guys got me, okay? But Luther says all this stuff. Okay, go ahead.
Katrina von Bora.
Katrina von Bora. It's put it on B-space, B-O-R, Katrina von Bora. Go ahead.
But is he saying that the man should have the pants in the relationship?
Yes.
But his wife is running the household.
Again, theorists do not always make sense, make concrete sense. That is a contradiction in terms. Yes, agreed. He's too busy writing. I guess he regards that as a higher calling, you might say. He's never gets away. Never gets away from his books. Luther loves his children very much. So I can't answer the question. How does it? It's enshrined. If Luther codifies a practice which is in, may or may not have been in existence. Love thy wife, as a first neighbor. I don't believe that the church would adhere to that doctrine. In any case, Luther loves his children very much. Luther begins to show his love for the children through writing poems and plays about them. He particularly likes the children at Christmas time, and there's a beautiful little poem that was written by Luther at Christmas in the year 1543. I hope I can read it because I didn't bring my glasses. Our little Lord, we have thee praised that thou hast deigned to take our ways. Born of a maid, man soon to be, and of all the angels sing to thee. The eternal Father's Son he lay. cradled in the arms of hay. The everlasting God appears. He falls in phrase upon our ears. What the globe could not enwrap, nestled lies in Mary's lap. Just a baby, very wee, yet Lord of all the world he be. Says this in 15th at Christmas time in 1540, and writes all kinds of poems to his children. Luther is a poet, among other, he's a composer, among other things. He's a lyricist, among others as well. Okay, so this is a little picture about Luther's life as a father and as a husband, as a father and as a husband. Let's talk about politics right now. Let's go back to politics and let's talk about the Holy Roman Empire, and let's talk about the emperor himself. Let's talk about the emperor himself. The emperor himself, none other than Charles V. Recall that Charles V, after promulgating the edict of Worms in May of 1521, he said Luther was a heretic whose book should be extirpated from the memory of man. He's a pagan in denial of free will. Charles goes away, and he's not back. He's not back until for 9 years. Doesn't come back for 9 whole years. Where does he go? First, he goes to England to visit his aunt. Then he goes to the Netherlands. Then he goes to the place he loves best in the world. He goes. The Netherlands is very close. He goes to Spain. He's hailed in Spain. He's the king. He is the king of Spain. King of Spain. Hailed in Spain. He marries a Portuguese princess. And under them would be born a son. His name will dominate the politics of the second half of the 16th century. His name is Philip, the son of Charles and this Portuguese princess. Charles is also off on the path to war. He fights wars with the Turks, and above all else, he fights wars with the French, and wars with the Turks. A famous war occurs in the year 1523 and ends in the year 1525 with the Battle of Pavia, P-A-V-I-A. Charles decisively defeats the king of France. This Battle of Pavia. He takes the king prisoner. For a year, king is holed up in Spain. The prisoner of Charles V of the Holy Roman Empire. The next year, Charles's confessor becomes Pope. His name is Adrian. His confessor becomes Pope. That's good for Charles. Good for Charles. His confessor becomes Pope. He only lives a year. That's bad for Charles. A new Pope comes along. His name is Clement VII. Clement does not like Charles. Clement fears Charles is becoming, as many people do, Charles is becoming too strong. After the King of France is released, Clement makes an alliance with the King of France against Charles V. Charles does not like that. Nor do Charles's troops. There's battles in the war. The war at first is a standoff. The new war between Charles and Francis I, the King of France, a very farsighted man. Francis I is a standoff. The troops do not get paid. The Swiss troops do not get paid. The Swiss do not like that at all. What do? They take it out. They don't take it out on Francis. They don't take it out on Charles. They take it out on Clement VII. In the year 1527, all Europe is horrified. Horrified when Swiss mercenaries sack. They sack the holy city of Rome. They desecrate the holy city of Rome. Building after building is smashed. People are killed in this sack of Rome. This, yes.
Are they Protestant or Catholic?
It doesn't make, but they're both. They fight on the side of Charles V. That's what they really doesn't care. All right, they don't get paid. That's what they're really pissed off about. All right, so they sack Rome. They sack Rome in 1527. 1527, all Europe is stunned to see this spectacle occur. The Holy Roman Emperor, the troops of Charles V, sack Rome. 1529. In 1529, Charles again defeats the King of France. By 1530, Charles V is master of Italy. By 1530. So he's got all these things. He goes back. He goes to England, then goes to the Netherlands, goes to Spain, marries a Spanish prince, a Portuguese. They have a kid. Kid's name is Philip. He beats the French in a battle. Takes the French king prisoner. A pope comes to power who's a friend, who's the confessor of Charles V. Good for Charles, but the pope only lives for a year. A new pope comes to power. The new pope is not on friendly terms with Charles at all. Makes an alliance with the king, whose release is negotiated by her aunt. And in Spain, don't want to talk about that right now. In any case, Charles is upset. The war is a standoff, and Charles's troops are not paid. They're not paid, and they take it out. They take it out, Protestant, Catholic, whatever. The Swiss want to be paid. They want to be paid when they fight. They're used to being paid. And when they're not paid, they don't take time. They sack Rome in the year 15, in the year 1527, 1529. By 1529, Charles has again defeated the king. By 1530, Charles is master of Italy. The Habsburg territory now extends from Spain all the way to Hungary. The Habsburgs are very powerful, and Charles thinks it's time to return home. To settle the schism. Charles convenes a diet. A diet which meets at Augsburg, in 1530. Meets at Augsburg in the year 1530. At this diet, Charles wants to settle the schism. It starts out very well. At this diet of Augsburg, Charles has his brother Ferdinand. At the Diet of Augsburg, Charles gets his brother elected King of the Romans. That means his brother's going to take his, can be sure, sure to take his place after Charles dies. He's not going to die. He's going to do something else. He's going to abdicate. All right? Professor Roland Bate has drawn a vivid picture of the entry of Charles into Augsburg. And I'd just like to read it. Just read it for a second. Read it once first, and you can take your hands off the laptops and lay down the, lay down the pencil. Just take the blood out of your hands for 5 minutes or so. When the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V approached the city of Augsburg, the dignitaries were out to receive him. As the notables knelt bareheaded for the benediction, Karl Compagno, the Elector of Saxony, stood bold upright. On the following day came one of the most beautiful processions in the history of medieval pageantry. In silk and damask, with gold brocade, in robes of crimson and colors appropriate to each house, came the electors of the empire, followed by the most exalted of their number, John of Saxony, carrying a sword with the ancient usage, carrying in accord with the ancient usage, the glittering sword of the emperor. Behind him marched Albert, Archbishop of Mainz, then the Bishop of Cologne, then the Bishop of Austria, and finally the brother, the bishop, the king of Austria, and brother of the emperor. Charles returns to Augsburg in the year 1530, and things at this diet really heat up. But let's go back a little bit in time to talk about what's been going on in Germany, going on in the German lands of the Holy Roman Empire while Charles was away. There's been his brother, Ferdinand, tried numerous times to convene the diets three or four times between the Peasants' War and 1526. Three things are apparent. The diets meet. There's a lot of meeting of the diets after the Peasants' War. And the diets can settle. Before the Peasants' War, between the Edict of Worms in 1521 and the Peasants' War of 1525. 1521, I meant to say, sorry. And 1525. But the diets cannot settle anything. Number one, the princes, the electors and the princes are too weak to enforce the Edict of Worms. None of them say outright they don't like the edict. None of them say that at all. Even Frederick the Wise doesn't say, but they're too weak. The princes, at their level, the princes cannot enforce the Edict of Worms at the territorial level. The same is true, too, of the mayors of the city. The magistrates of the city. If Luther is just too popular. I said this before, but of all the cities, only four ban Lutherism. And two of them are in the Netherlands. And the condition of the Holy Roman Empire is not yet ripe enough to permit the emergence of political parties. There's still no political parties between 1521 and 1525. No political parties. The mayors aren't strong enough to enforce the magistrates in the cities, and the princes are not strong enough to enforce the Edict of Worms. At the territorial level. This changes very dramatically when a new diet is called at Speyer by Ferdinand in the year 1526. What's going on? Charles is at war. Charles is again at war with the King of France. The Ottoman Turks are halfway into Hungary. And what is the king of Austria, brother of Charles I, what is he going to do? And now, Now there is some, there emerges among the princes and the electors the first clear-cut division. They discuss the Peasants' War of 1525, and they discuss the Turks. It is some of the princes, some of the electoral princes, some of the princes in the College of Princes. So the Catholics say the only one way to deal with this, form a league against Luther. Form a league against Martin Luther. Stamp out the Lutheran heresy. But there now emerges, for the first time, a party with a contrary point of view. Leading this party, he's going to figure throughout this lecture in a big way, is the very handsome Margrave of Hesse. His name is Philip of Hesse. Philip, and also to some extent, the new elector of Saxony, John, they say they have a different approach. Lutheranism should not be stamped out. Lutheranism is a bulwark of order. Luther proves that when he wrote the book on the peasants. When he wrote the terrible of the peasants. Lutheranism is a bulwark. They say in their estates, Luther is a bulwark of order to be preserved, not to be stamped out. Pity the poor emperor, and he's not the emperor, pity Ferdinand I of Austria. He's got one group yelling for Luther's head, another group saying no, not yet that large, the Margrave of Hesse, and the Elector of Saxony saying, no, that's not the way to, is a bulwark of order. A fateful decision is made at the Diet of Speyer. Until there will be a council convened to discuss the religious schism, and the peasants' question, and the council convened to discuss the peasants' question and the religious question. Until the time as this council meets, every prince, every magistrate throughout the empire will act in accordance with the laws of God and the dictates of conscience as reflected towards the emperor. The laws of God and the dictates of conscience respecting the emperor. That sounds like a lot of nothing, a lot of fraud. But it's not. Nowhere in that glossy formula, act in accordance with the laws of God and the desires of the emperor. Nowhere is there the word, the Edict of Worms. It doesn't appear. It's not there. What the Diet of 1526 at Speyer does, what the Diet does for the first time, this foreshadows a peace of 1555, the Lutherans get de facto recognition. De facto recognition to practice their religion throughout the Holy Roman Empire. A big deal, covered over by this glossy formula. They're going to act in accordance with the laws of God and the desires of the king. Nowhere is the Edict of Worms mentioned. So basically a prince can do what he feels like. Although princes always try to think they're obeying God and answering, they interpret that very differently. They interpret that this council never meets. There's a number of things that prevent the council from ever meeting. 3 years go by. A new diet is convened by the emperor. Excuse me, I keep saying the emperor. He's not emperor yet. A new diet is convened by Ferdinand at Speyer again. He needs money to fight a new war with the Turks. The Turks are at it again. He asks money from the estates, money from his, from the princes, money from, you okay, Thibault? Okay. Money from the estates. Philip and John of Saxony said the question of money for war cannot be separated from the religious question. Cannot be separated from the religious question. The Catholics throughout the empire say, we won't give money, we won't give you any money if something is not done about the edict that was proclaimed in 1526. Well, Ferdinand and Charles communicate. Charles has one way of dealing with the situation, a conciliatory way, but that never reaches his brother Ferdinand. Or if it does reach it, Ferdinand decides to suppress it. Ferdinand's accountants tell him, look, we got a war on our hands. We got a big war on our hands. And whatever, the Catholics have more money than the Lutherans do. So a rescript, a provisional edict, is decreed in the year 1529. It says, 1, the Edict of Worms shall be enforced in all Catholic lands of the Holy Roman Empire. The Edict of Worms should be enforced in all Catholic lands of the Holy Roman Empire. In Lutheran lands, the Catholics will have the right of worship. In Lutheran lands, the Catholics will have the right to worship. In Catholic lands, that won't be true for the Lutherans. That will not be true. The Lutherans will not have the same rights in the Catholic lands as the Catholics have in the Lutheran lands. Catholicism is again restored all over the empire. The Edict of Worms only enforced, however, in the Catholic land. But the main thing is Catholicism is basically restored all over the empire because the Lutherans are free to practice their religion in their state, but they've got to let the Catholics do it too. The same freedom is not accorded to the Lutherans in Catholic land. Well, the Margrave of Hesse and the Elector of Saxony, together with two other princes from the college and 14 members of the College of the Princes, 14 cities and 4 electors, lodge a protest against this new provisional rescript or edict in 1529. They lodge a protest. I said protest. They become known as Protestants. And from here on out, we can use the word Protestants to describe the Lutheran Reformation, or we will not be off base. The Protestants, for the first time, the word appears. It goes back to 1520. The 4 electors and the 14 cities who protest this edict that comes down and that reverses 1526. Well, now, the Diet is about to meet. Charles is on his way back to Augsburg. Charles is on his way back to Augsburg. This demands number the Protestants protested the repeal of the edict of 1526. Philip, the Margrave of Hesse, wants to form a league against the Catholics. And he also wants Zwingli and Luther to bury the hatchet, if you will. Well, this all one thing happens. The idea of a league, says Luther, is anathema to him. The idea of a league right now is anathema to him. He writes He writes to Philip. He writes to Philip, if I can find it. He writes to Philip, the Margrave of Hesse. Margrave, we cannot in conscience approve such a league, inasmuch as bloodshed or some other disaster shall be the outcome, and we would find ourselves so involved that we would not be able to withdraw if we wanted to. Better 10 times dead than our consciences be buried with the insufferable weight of such a disaster, and that our gospel be the cause of bloodshed, when we ought rather to be as sheep for the slaughter and not able to avenge or defend ourselves. Powerful words. Luther does not want to take part in a league against Charles V of the Holy Roman. Better 10 times dead, says Luther. That attitude's not going to last for too much longer. One, the idea of kissing and making up with Zwingli is something else. The people who protest the edict of 1529, the edict of the rescript of 1529, rescript means a temporary edict. They can agree on one thing. They're faithful to the divine word of God. The Protestants are faithful to the divine word of God. Well, what on earth does that mean? There must be a healing in the ranks. A schism among the Protestants themselves. Zwingli on one side, Luther on the other. They sit down. They sit down in early 1530. And they try to work out the major difference they have, whether or not Christ is present in the sacrament. Whether or not Christ is present in the sacrament. Zwingli says, Marty, I'll cut you some slack. I'll agree that Christ is symbolic. I'll go so far and to say he's spiritually present in the sacrament. Luther says, I'll cut you some slack, Hank. I'll go you better, I'll see you one. I'll say not physically, but substantively. See, you've got spiritually with Zwingli, substantively with Luther. It doesn't work. Zwingli does not want to accept the compromise at all. Zwingli's got a crisis going on. A crisis going on back in Sweden. He says, no way. Luther says, bye. Zwingli goes back to Switzerland, fights a war with the Catholics, and is killed, stabbed to death in the year 1531. Afterwards, the influence of Zwingli begins to wane. But that still leaves the idea, what are the Lutherans going to do? They need a statement of principles. They need a confession. Confession meaning a statement basically of what you believe. And they get together very dramatically in April of 15, March of 1530, and they draft a statement of 28 of their beliefs. 28 of their beliefs, which constitute the core of the Lutheran faith, and becomes known as the Augsburg Confession. The Augsburg Confession of 1530. The Augsburg Confession of it is all Luther. The Zwingli offers his own confession, but it doesn't work. You know what it says, the Augsburg Confession. It's Luther, lock, stock, and barrel. Justification by faith. Priesthood of all believers. Priesthood of all believers. Infant baptism. The sacrament. In both kinds, that is to say, bread and wine Bread and wine for the whole congregation. Bread and wine for the whole congregation. The Lord's Supper. Not effective unless one has faith. Cannot stand on its own. Justification by faith. Priesthood of all believers. Lord's Supper cannot stand on its own. You have to have faith. And the presence of Christ in the sacrament. And they also have things like the infant baptism. And there are 28 articles that becomes known as the Augsburg Confession. Well, here now Charles comes. You've got your procession and all the damask and the brocades and so forth, and people bowing on their knees and falling all over. He opens the diet. He opens the diet in 1530. Gets his brother elected king of the Romans. A big deal. A big deal. And he asked the Lutherans to present at the Diet of Augsburg their confession. A statement of what they believe. They give it to him. They read. Melanchthon, Luther's side, read the 28, don't have to remember the name, the 28 articles of the Augsburg Confession. Charles listens to it and says, you have until the 15th day of April, 1531, to recant or feel the full force of the sword. 1531 you've got. Basically a year to recant or feel the full force of the sword. Politics now. The Margrave of Hesse, Philip. The Elector of Saxony, Frederick. We had Frederick the Wise. Then we have John. Now we just have Frederick. I don't know if he got a title or not. They decide it's time for the Protestants. It's time for the Lutherans to band together. Time for the to band together. Yes.
Could you go over with those two people?
The Margrave of Hesse was one. The electors of Saxony, Frederick the Wise, John, and then just Frederick. Okay. They go. They get together. They get together and they form a league, a very famous league. Called the Schmalkaldic League. Schmalkaldic League formed in the year 1532. Schmalkaldic League formed in the year 1532. What do we want to say about the Schmalkaldic League? A couple of things. A couple of very important things. The Schmalkaldic League. One. There are six, we'll see when I get through, to note about the Schmalkaldic. The first thing is its extent. It is coterminous with the boundaries of the empire. It is coterminous with the boundaries of the empire. The second thing, it's geographical. Geographical, or it is organized in the north, led by the Elector of Saxony, and it is organized in the south, led by the Margrave of Hesse, Philip of Hesse. Hesse, Philip, in the north, in the south. In the north, the Elector John, Frederick of Saxony. It's huge. It is huge. It's formed in 1532. It's formed in 15 all over Germany. In the north, the commander is Frederick of Saxony. In the south, the commander is Philip, Margrave of Hesse. The next thing we want to note about it, the frequency of its meetings, 26 times in 15 years. 26 times it meets in the 15 years. In the 15 years it is in existence. Four. Four, it's organization again. It's internal. It's internal organization. It's internal. It meets 26 times. The electors sit with the princes, and the princes sit with the cities. The electors, princes, and all sit together. It's not like the diets of the Holy Roman Empire. They all sit together in the Schmalkaldically. Four, it's powers of attraction. In its heyday in the late 1530s, the Schmalkaldically attract some curious applicants. The King of England applies for membership. The King of France applies for membership. Both of them are turned down because they're Catholic. It's not going to make much of a difference in too much life. They're turned down. They are. But it also gets some very important converts, very important people, very important members in Germany. Try this on for size. The Elector of Brandenburg, hitherto a devout Catholic, turns Lutheran, and he joins the Schmalkaldic League. Try this on for size. The Duke of Saxony, not electoral Saxony. Remember George, the most vociferous, the most powerful, the most vituperative critic in all of the Holy Roman Empire. Well, his son turns Lutheran and joins the Schmalkaldic League. Five, it's growth and effectiveness. By the year 1541, the Schmalkaldic League has a constitution, a military council, and a treasury. A constitution, a military council, and a treasury, Six, its effect on the institutions of the Holy Roman Empire. One institution, remember, we've got the Diet, we've got the College of Princes, we've got the College of the Electors, we've got the College of the Free Cities, but we also have something else. You may have forgotten, it's the Supreme Court, the Reichskammergericht. The Supreme Court of the Holy Roman Empire. The Schmalkaldic League won't pay taxes to it. And after 1544, the operation of the Supreme Court, one of the institutions of the Holy Roman Empire. Remember that. Just like the circles, the 10 circles, the colleges of the electors, of the princes, of the free cities, the Supreme Court, the court, the judicial arm, begins to go. Do you have a question?
Yeah, why wasn't there a lot of opposition against this? I mean, it seemed like
there was 15 years. There is. Give me a minute. Okay. The opposition on the part of Luther, which is overcome, in the 15 years it's in existence. Okay. But to answer that, Luther has a different beginning. They ask, yes. After 1544, it's suspended after 1544. I don't know when it meets again. Maybe I'll find out, but it's suspended after 1544. So you see what devastating the reason of all this goes on. What's your first name, Ben?
Matthew.
The reason of this is that the Catholics have pushed things a little too far. But we'll see what. In the meantime, Luther just has a change of heart when it comes to taking up the sword. He looks at the Bible sometime, and he sees that Paul, in a letter to Paul, that a subject never can rise up against powers. But that's plural. But we're talking about powers now. One power can check the sword of another power and still operate within the confines of the Bible. Luther changes his mind about that. So it's okay with Luther. The league begins, the league to Philip, the league begins. The league begins as a defensive operation against Charles V. Why does it last? Why there's not opposition at first? Because it doesn't do anything aggressive. That's one reason. As the 1540s wear on, the league grows more and more powerful, and it begins to intervene in Catholic states, begins to intervene in Catholic territories of the Holy Roman Empire. So we got all those points. You want me to go over them again?
Please.
All right. What's important about? What is important about the Schmalkaldic? It's sweep. It's geographical extent. It's coterminous with the boundaries of the empire. Two, north and south. It's got a commander in the north and a commander in the south. Philip of Hesse in the south, the elector of Saxony, the elector of Saxony in the north. Three, the number and times it meets. 26 times in 15 years. 26 times in 15 years. Four, its powers of attraction. It attracts applications from the King of England, applications from the King of France. They're turned down. But it also attracts applications that are accepted. The electorate of Brandenburg, a Catholic stronghold. Brandenburg turns Lutheran. The same thing in non-electoral Saxony. Duke George has died. His son, the son of the man who's the most vituperative critic of applies to the Schmalkaldically as well. So Duke George and the Elector of Brandt powers of its organization. By 1541, it has a military council, it's got a constitution, and it's got a treasury. Finally, its effect on the institutions of the Holy Roman Empire. It won't pay taxes to the Supreme Court. That's in the long and short of it. And as a result, the Supreme Court's operations are suspended. And it begins to feel so powerful that this defensive league formed for defensive purposes in response to the Edict of Augsburg of Charles V begins to intervene in Catholic territory. In the meantime, Charles is off again fighting wars, and something happens in the middle 1540s that begins to tell against the Schmalkaldic League. The Margrave of Hesse, the commander of the forces in the commander of Schmalkaldic League in the south, handsome guy, he knows it. The women in the Holy Roman Empire know it. He falls in love. He falls head over heels in love with a 17-year-old princess. What?
I'm joking.
I thought that was probably cool back then. No. 1541, I believe. Well, the princess has a mother. Both of them say, no marriage, no bed. If you want to sleep with me, you got to marry me. Remember, these are revolutionary times, Thibault, okay? Revolutionary times. No bed, no marriage, that's it. The only problem is that the Margrave is married. And bigamy is a capital offense in the Holy Roman Empire. What's a Margrave to do? He consults Martin Luther. Luther said, you know, if you had been Catholic, this would have all been great. You could have had the marriage annulled, but he's not Catholic. He said, I want a divorce. Luther says, never happen. Divorces are only are approved on grounds of adultery. He says, how do you know my wife has not been adulterous? Luther says, I don't, but you don't know it either, so no, you can't do it there. Luther searches the Old Testament and contrives, that's the word, twists, distorts a scripture in the Old Testament. Say that bigamy. Bigamy is justified. It comes from Martin Luther. It does. Bigamy is justified. Well, Philip marries the German princess. He is accused. They would try to shut this up. But the princess, and especially her mother, are too proud. They've got a husband who's Margrave of Hesse. And they blab it all over Europe, all over the empire. All over the empire. And as a result, Philip, the Margrave of Hesse, defects from the Schmalkaldic League, hoping to win favor from Charles the First, or Charles the Fifth of the Holy Roman Empire. Charles the Fifth of the Holy Roman Empire. It says this, if I can, take this time out. The mood of the half decade that preceded the calm. The mood of the half decade that preceded the empire's first religious war, whoops, is suggested by an incident in March 1546. On his way to the Diet of Regensburg, Charles is coming back. Charles is coming back. Emperor Charles stopped by Speyer. In rode the Hessian landgrave, Philip of Hesse, hawk on arm, with 200 men. As they hunted together, the emperor and vassal dined, and Charles asked Philip how things were going in the Schmalkaldic League. My gracious emperor, Philip replied, I am missing only one man. To the emperor's query, who might that man be? Philip replied, why, I have to mean your majesty himself. The two men chuckled. Charles said, ha ha, no, I will not join. I will not join the party of error. The dinner ended presumably in friendly spirit, though in the high summer, quite a different mood would prevail. What happens is Philip of Hesse, wanting favor with Charles, defects from the Schmalkaldic League. Defects from the Schmalkaldic. That's not all. There's another person in Saxony. Not in Saxony. There's a person in Saxony, a prince in Saxony. His name is Maurice. Maurice would like the emperor to name him to get the electoral title away from Frederick. He defects as well, and the emperor believes the time has come to settle things with the Schmalkaldic League. In the spring of 1547, Charles V, on his way, convenes a diet at Regensburg in central Germany. The Schmalkaldic forces believe this is a prelude to an attack. What do they do? In the spring of 1547, the Schmalkaldic League attacks Charles. Charles not only has the Swiss mercenaries with him, he's got the Schwabian League, the army of his brother. The Schmalkaldiners are defeated. Charles V, the League. The League breaks up. Charles V of the Holy Roman Empire rides into Wittenberg. Luther, who had died 1 year before, he rides past the grave of Martin Luther. And he says now all the Protestants, all Protestants throughout the Holy Roman Empire will lose their lands, their titles, and their heads. Although he doesn't say heads. He cuts that off on the advice of more moderate advice. They're going to lose their titles. They're going to lose their land. They're going to lose their land. Charles wins a Pyrrhic. You know what that word means? Pyrrhic victory. The victory is not all that victorious. Charles does not give Philip what he wants. And he's got this pledge to Maurice of Saxony. He wants to be the elector. He's at the height of his power now. Charles does not honor a promise he made or implied to Maurice of Saxony. Maurice doesn't take kindly to that. And he and his forces, the northern part, what's left of the Schmalkaldic League, form an alliance with the King of France. With Henry II, the young King of France. They promise Henry that in return for a victorious war against Charles, they'll make him Holy Roman Emperor. By this time, Charles V, the warlord, in office, on the throne since 1519, has had enough. He's not well. He's not well. He's sick of Lutheranism. He flees. He flees in the wake of the French king. In the wake of the French king, Henry II, who's been promised holy to be Holy Roman Emperor in the event of victory, because he didn't give Maurice what he wanted. In the end, Charles flees to Italy. His brother Ferdinand steps in and makes a peace. The Peace of Passau. All we need to remember about the Peace of Passau is that it restores things to the way they were in 1526. Basically, the Peace of Passau says that gives Lutheranism, de facto recognition in the Holy Roman Empire. De facto recognition in the Holy Roman. And we'll see how this translates into a peace that ends for 50 years the religious schism with the Peace of Augsburg 3 years later in the year 1555 at the beginning of the next hour.